We are about to start our third year of podcasting, and as we look back, there is one thing we cannot deny.
It's because of you, our listeners, our day ones, our international coalition. Indy, I see you.
You came to our live shows, listened to thousands of episodes, responded with likes and comments on our social media, and helped us make moves in an industry where everyone has a podcast.
We have released over 250 episodes, serving you some of our best analysis and interviewing some of the biggest names, along with those making an impact in the wrestling industry.
So we just want to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just wanted to say thank you, I guess.
Come on, Matt Michaels, be nice.
Go! Prepare yourself for another year of...
Welcome to another edition of Wrestling Talk.
This is the DeFalco Files with the one and only Joe DeFalco.
This is Three Count.
Hey everybody, it's Matt Michaels, and this is People I Don't Hate.
Prepare yourselves for another year of douchebaggery, hijinks, and some talking out of the ass from all of us at the Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting.
Vegas Bad Boy of Podcasting is an entertainment-based wrestling program. The opinions shared are that of the host and their guest. Some celebrity voices are impersonated and usually not well. This program is not intended for kids and certain adults. Listener's discretion is advised. You have been warned. Now let's get ready to podcast.
Welcome to another edition of Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting. I'm your host, DJ Impact, and I got most of the bad boys here with me. It's always good to see you fellas once again. And we're going to kick right off with our three count. We got three good stories for you, so let's just start with the first one. It's time. Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting presents...
One, two, three.
Count Talk.
Count Talk, baby.
One!
It's from WrestlingInc.com titled, Note on Keith Lee and Others Being Sent to WWE PC. And so as it is written, it is noted that five superstars from the WWE main roster, Keith Lee, Omos, Otis, Dabba Kato, and Mace, are being sent to WWE Performance Center to undergo two training classes per week in order to, quote, refine and improve their in-ring skills. And according to Dave Meltzer, the decision is not being viewed as a demotion, but rather a case of Vince McMahon wanting to get them ready for potential pushes down the road. Meltzer had also noted that McMahon just got mad because he thinks none of these guys know how to work. End quote. Wow. And needed to polish up their skills inside the square circle. And with regard to Keith Lee, especially, Meltzer mentioned that in Vince's mind, he is not ready, even though the talent is undeniable. Okay, fellas, I mean, that's pretty interesting, huh? Back to the Performing Arts Center. Or the Performance Center, I'm sorry.
Performance Center, they're sending him to Juilliard. They're sending him to Juilliard. I knew they were in contract with Juilliard.
Yeah, back to the Performance Center. But Vince McMahon is trying to refine their skills. He doesn't think they're putting in the work. Where do you guys see with this particular? I mean, it's not a demotion, but is it? I mean, you're got the top and you're going back down to the bottom. I mean, I don't know. What's your guys' take on this?
You're saying you're going back down to the bottom, but that's very misleading.
Yeah. It is. But NXT, right now, listen, we know the level of NXT. We do know that it is a...
But they're not going to NXT.
Yeah. All they're doing is going to the Performance Center to take some classes. Think of it like this, okay?
Gotcha.
And I'm sorry to cut you in because I think I'm thinking the same thing you're doing, Matt. Yeah. You can go to college and not declare a major and still take classes or certifications. Do you see what I'm saying? So you have to kind of look at this situation such as is this, is they're going back to take classes. And the reason why I was a little thrown back by Keith Lee until I started watching him, if I was being hypercritical with glasses on Keith Lee, what is one thing he could work on? I noticed that sometimes, and this is me, I feel like his selling could be better.
Okay.
I don't know if anybody else catches that. And I do feel that some of his promos, although they're good in a certain way, I think that they can be better. Now, talent-wise,
I doubt they're going to work on promos with him, but
yeah.
Let's face it, guys. And to call a beaver a beaver, the Otis and Keith Lee and maybe Dabo as well, but let's face it, these guys are fat guys.
I knew you were going to say that, but I didn't want to say it. Thank you for saying that. I'm sorry. I know
that's Vince's fucking, he sees potential in them, but the fact of the matter is too, if they were going around doing the touring schedule, then this would be kind of a little more news, but they're already fucking there. Why not?
Well, I was a little confused on that. So at the Performance Center, I mean, that's where everyone goes to work out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to train.
Yeah.
That's all.
So wouldn't they be doing that anyway? Why is it?
Not necessarily.
Okay. So you could be there working. You could be there working out, but not. Okay. This is being required. I got you.
Yeah. Ultimately, yeah. I mean, it just comes down to, like Matt made a perfect point. I mean, it's, you know, the size of the guys was it. There was no coincidence that it was this group of guys that have been sent down, you know, to refine things in the PC. I mean, realistically speaking, forever, Vince has envisioned a particular working style for big men. And I think that was what made Keith Lee stand out on the indie scene, was that he did not, you know, he did not confine himself to working a strictly big man style match.
Right.
So that was what got a lot of the spotlight on him. However, it's a double-edged sword when you get to a certain level and you're expected to work that style of a match, and you can't be doing moonsaults and, you know, high flying moves and, you know, all this kind of stuff. I mean, like I said, it's a double-edged sword, and it sucks to have it be a requirement. But at the end of the day, this is par for the course. I mean, I wish I could say that I was surprised when I read that this was happening, especially people like Otis, who he's been a comedy babyface his entire run. If Vince actually didn't give a shit about any of these guys, then he wouldn't send them to the PC to have, you know, things refined. He would just pay them no mind and give them no TV time and then release them once their contract is up. So I think that if nothing else, this is a positive. Okay. And dare I say, I think that these guys are at least embracing it and are looking at it from that point of view. So, I mean, I wish these guys all the best. Being a person of size, I know, you know, how difficult it can be to lose some weight, and it sucks to do, but if they're dangling the carrot in front of you, no pun intended, then, you know, and they're making these promises that, you know, like the interaction that Keith Lee had with Vince McMahon in the WWE 24 documentary, where Vince point blank told him that he sees the world in him, but he needs, you know, he needs to get the fans buy-in on him. And, you know, you can do so much in the ring, but at the end of the day, people are drawn to at least somewhat of a particular body type in the ring. And in the rare occasion when you're not that body type, then you have to have something extremely special to make you stand out. So I think that Vince feels that for these guys to progress, that he needs to send them to the PC. And at the same token, he didn't want to send all of the, or he didn't want to send just one of them, because that would, that could be, you know, thrown back on him as being unfair for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. I think that it honestly set a good precedent that he sent, you know, the five guys that he did to the PC, rather than just saying, hey, Keith Lee, you need to go here and you need to do this. I think that it was approached as best as possible. And quite frankly, you know, when I first read it, I was like, oh, this sucks. But then after seeing the 24 documentary, seeing everything and actually giving it some thought, it's 100% spot on.
Okay. And you know what, one thing that you that we also have to look at too is resources. So let's just say if there was no pandemic and you were on the road, a lot of these wrestlers, because we had opportunities to see how some of them work out when we go visit them, you know, in town, and we see them in the same gym. We're working out. I was working out in the gym and I saw Charlotte early in the morning, which was kind of interesting. So, but they don't have all the faculties that you would have at the performance center, such as a trainer there that can augment the way you're working out with. So that's a huge advantage. But the one thing that you said based on the documentary that is really, really important is because Vince McMahon sees the world and he's thinking for the long haul. And when I think of a big man like Keith Lee, for example, does a lot of those high flyer moves. Yeah, that's okay for now because you have good long break in between. But when pandemic's over, you're doing all those high flying moves. You're doing more shows. Now, mind you, house shows is no longer a thing. That's going to wear and tear on your body. Having too much weight can wear and tear on your body with impact when you are doing things. And so he just wants to make sure that the engine is oiled and can go, you know, for as long as it needs to. So kudos to them for being positive about it. I'm expecting to see great things.
Let's also not forget that the actuality though is that they're going to be working in ring style. Mm-hmm. Because Dabba Kato and AJ's bodyguard, those guys need to be wrestling like every fucking day, not just 2 days a week.
Yep. Especially AJ's manager, because for how big he is, I always think of the biggest people in like the Great Khali. Great Khali was great to look at, but boy, when you saw him, I swear he had twig legs half the time. So that's something you have to work around as a selling point. Okay, we know he probably is not the most athletic or at least coordinated in certain ways. What's the way we can still wrap that up and sell it? And what better way than to utilize the performance center for that?
All right. Guys, let's jump over into our second count, which is from WrestlingNewWorld.com. And it is titled, Is the Wednesday Night War a Fair Fight? I'll just read you a little bit of what the writer is saying. He said, after pondering this question over the last few weeks, I've come to the conclusion that there are three possible answers to the question, is the Wednesday Night War a fair fight? And the answers are yes, no, AEW has the advantage, and no, NXT has the advantage. So he goes through and he lays out the article for arguments for all three options, and then he gives his opinion as to which conclusion he found most compelling, which I'm going to jump over to that one first. And he says, after looking at the arguments, as well as watching some of the best matches from both NXT and AEW from over the last year, I was surprised to see that I think that Dynamite holds a slight advantage over NXT. The deep roster, its status as AEW's A show, and the backing of the TNT all give it an edge that cannot be bought by WWE simply willing NXT to be worthy opponent. So that being said, I do think that this advantage always leads to AEW presenting a better product each week, but it does make sense why new and casual fans have been turning into TNT on Wednesday nights over NXT. Sometimes NXT is more fun to watch. Other times, AEW present a far superior product. Now, that, of course, that's all his opinions. So I'm going to come and ask you guys, though, is the Wednesday night war a fair fight? And if you base it off his answers, it's either just simply yes or no, AEW has an advantage, or no, NXT has the advantage. What say you, Simon Street?
I really don't like the question because it's very much lacking context, but I mean, I'll entertain, why not? Are we talking about long-term fight or just the fight right now?
Now, remember, there was a lot in this article he went over.
I know.
He went over 3 points as to why he gave his answers for all three. So really, you're just determining based on his breakdown, do you see any of those as being, I mean, is, you know, do you see those being an answer to the question he's proposing? Or we could come back to you. And
I think it is a fair fight. And the reason why I say it's a fair, do I get to explain or do I just say?
No, you can explain. That's okay, fine.
Okay. The reason why I think it's a fair fight is because although NXT has the slight edge in the long term, AEW is, in all intents and purposes, is sitting on the right recipe. They just haven't put together are the right ingredients. But they just haven't put together the right recipe to consistently contend and get to that million mark and keep it consistent. My personal opinion, but I do feel that once AEW gets that recipe right, the ingredients are there. They do have a deep roster, maybe not particularly the women's division as of yet, but they have a deep roster. They actually have the money behind it, which is required to maintain. They just haven't figured out how to put it together. And like I said, whenever that happens, NXT is going to have to step up their game to elevate from what they've consistently been doing, what they have consistently been doing for most weeks where they have maintained W's.
So you feel that one has an advantage over the other, or you just feel that it's
why I didn't want to be boxed in, but it's a fair fight. Let's just say it's a fair fight.
Okay, let's go over to you, Sin City. What's your take on this when you read this? Do you agree? Is the Wednesday night war a fair fight? His selection is its answer is yes or no. AEW has the advantage, or no, NXT has the advantage.
So I think that the winner of this debate is actually Robbie D. Shazier, who obviously got paid per word in this article. because he wrote paragraph after paragraph after paragraph. And at the end of the day, he really said a whole lot of nothing. I do think that it's a fair fight if we have to choose one of the options. Mm-hmm. But realistically speaking, you know, if you want to point to the money backing, okay, Vince, we all know how much money Vince has. The Khan family has just as much money as Vince does. As far as a roster goes, you've got technically three rosters that you can pull from if worse came to worse. And they've done it whenever they've needed to pop a rating. Oh, well, let's just trot Charlotte Flair out here to NXT. Let's pop a rating for a month. Okay, great. How many times can they do that? Okay, great. Now, AEW, how many times are we going to have the Impact champion or, you know, whoever we're signing talent agreements with, how many times are we going to have them on our show to pop a rating? I mean, the same tools can be employed by both companies, and both companies should, in theory, fuel each other to rise up. Something that stands out for me is on the last Wednesday of Wednesday night viewership, there were actually more people ages 18 to 49, which is, I don't care what anyone says, that is the money demographic. When you combined the total number of people that watched AEW and NXT, nearly three times as many people aged 18 to 49 watched either one of those shows compared to Monday Night Raw. Those numbers were neck and neck, mm-hmm, with what SmackDown pulled in, and that was on broadcast Fox. So I think that we're starting to see that these two companies are starting to go head to head, and they're starting to pull out more and more stops. And I think that it's only going to get better for us, the fans, And, you know, realistically, we should just sit back and enjoy the ride. Yeah, we can pick our favorite horse in the race if we want to. But at the end of the day, when the tide comes in, all boats rise.
What do you think on that, Matt Michaels?
So, it's one of those articles that, as I'm looking over, just to kind of, you know, catch any main points, it's so fucking ridiculous because the question is the Wednesday night war a fair fight? His answer is yes, this is a fair fight. No, NXT has the advantage. No, AEW has the advantage. So basically what he's saying is I'm going every single route to say, you know, this way, that way, other, you know, he just contradicts himself totally. It's fucking ridiculous.
Well, he makes a point for each one of those, and then he chooses one of the best three at the very end. But he makes a case for each one of those as to how each one of those could be someone's selection as an answer.
And so, but his, after looking at the arguments as well as watching some of the best matches from both NXT and AEW from over the last year, by the way, he just looks at quote unquote the best, some of the best matches. Mm-hmm. And so he was surprised to see that I think that Dynamite holds a slight advantage over NXT. The deep roster, its status as AEW's A show, and the backing of TNT all give it an edge that cannot be bought by WWE simply willing NXT to be a worthy opponent. So therefore, A, he makes my thing that I say all the time, it's not a fucking war. If he literally just pointed out that the WWE is just simply not willing to, you know, they're not doing the same thing AEW is doing to make it their A show. Mm-hmm. It's not the WWE's A show, and they're the minor league fucking system technically for the WWE. So it's kind of a ridiculous comparison just based on that. And then he says, that being said, I do not think that this advantage always leads to the AEW presenting a better product each week. But it does make sense why new and casual fans have been turning in to TNT on Wednesday nights over NXT. Some of NXT is more fun to watch. Other times, AEW presents a fair, superior product. What the fuck? He just said, NXT is fun to watch sometimes. AEW is fun to watch sometimes. So what the fuck is the problem here? What's the war? Steve, not only is he getting paid per word, he's getting paid per letter and probably getting a fucking bonus on top of it for spelling his goddamn name correctly.
You know what's funny that you said that, Michaels, is that's really the problem in a nutshell with this whole Wednesday night war. I think it was perpetuated by the super marks. You know, and initially as a war, but we've been saying it every week in, week out. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, there's things that need to, each party could do better, particularly AEW because they're developing. But the goal's always been for them, and you've merely said this a lot, you want to get that million mark and maintain it and hold it. Yeah, I still think that's their business structure. Will it really be like Monday Night Wars? I think everybody wants that and are trying to push that narrative from day one. And that's not really the case in reality. And even I want it, but it's not the reality. There are two shows that coincidentally are on the same day. Yeah, maybe WWE purposely put NXT on there because they want to get some of that money on the table for what was already going to be Dynamite on Wednesday.
Exactly. You're right. The other thing, too, that kind of – So Chris Jericho is an established name, a respected name, should have been your first champion just out of the legitimacy of your title. Okay. Outside of that, right now, John Moxley. If John Moxley was on WWE TV, would he have the same impact? Possibly. Well, possibly. And the only reason I say that is this. Look at what they've done with Seth. Look at what they've done with Roman. Right now, you have Roman Reigns as arguably one of the best heels in the business. You have Seth as arguably one of the best heels in the business. And honestly, if Moxley is there, you probably have Moxley as one of the best heels in the business. Because those three guys were fucking talented.
Mm-hmm. Moxley was he one of the top three heels in the business when he was there?
No.
But I can answer that why. Whenever I get a second, you go ahead and finish.
Yeah, no, I was gonna say, because at the same time, Roman Reigns wasn't either. Everyone was crying about Roman Reigns to the fact that you would think that fans just wanted him to fucking go. Get the fuck out of here. But God forbid, Moxley, oh my God, Dean Ambrose was a fucking, he was so misutilized. Well, the fact of the matter is that at that time too, remember, John Cena was still on the show, right? So he was taking up space. You have certain people that were taking up space that potentially, if Moxley's contract wasn't up, Moxley would be in a certain position right now. Hmm. And then he goes on, though, to use Moxley, then Cody, who, listen, if Cody Rhodes just doesn't go on his own fucking merit and start his own goddamn fucking company, Cody Rhodes is not your top draw. I'm sorry. As talented as he is, he's not fucking cracking that top. And then on top of that, you got to say Brody Lee. And it's like, listen, at the same time, yeah, he's getting a chance to do something a little different, but do you really put that much stake? So this is the difference. The difference is these guys weren't getting the opportunity on the, Raw or SmackDown, your A-level shows. Mm-hmm. If the WWE wanted to, if those guys were, let's say, still around, would those guys not be either your top of your NXT or still, except for Moxley, guys like Cody, guys like Miro, for fuck's sake, who, I mean, listen, everyone wants to say, oh, he was so fucking misused and stuff. What are they doing with him that's any better other than having him come out at a fucking run-in at the end of a goddamn show in fucking Zumbas and, look like he's literally one of the fucking audience members who's on vacation in Florida fucking jumping on stage. it's such a fucking weak, argument to say that one is doing better than the other in terms of this or that. They're totally separate products. And the winners in all this is one fucking thing, and that is the goddamn fans.
Yep.
That's it. Because now you have more choices to watch. And most wrestling fans, let's face it, they watch all the fucking programs. That's it. Outside of you getting the new eyes and hopefully retaining them in terms of the younger demographic for AEW, and that's how they're going to build. The idea is NXT, they don't have to do that because when those characters come up to the WWE anyway, they're going to be different characters, most likely, tweaked in some manner. Mm-hmm. So even what you liked about someone in the NXT, when they get to WWE, it is going to, like Rhea Ripley right now, I think every fucking fan should be shuddering at the thought of her going to Raw.
Oh.
And, it's just... And yeah, the matchups will be fucking hell of fire, right? You're going to see her against the, you know, the potential.
Have her go against Nia Jax.
Nia Jax and other. And
Baszler.
Yeah, Baszler. Rousey, if she ever, you know, if she does come back. But at the same time, what I love here is he said that AEW's roster is so fucking loaded. And I'm going, no, WWE's roster is loaded, because you look at a girl like that coming up to the division and the women's division. She's got all those names to either feud with or actually have to somehow surpass to take a spot. Whereas in AEW, you can basically say, okay, Moxley, right? Jericho. You can say MJF. You could say Sammy Guevara. You could go with Cody, I guess, and Omega, of course. Are they really that stacked, though? Because you can find someone who potentially can come from either another organization or from their own organization or from an independent organization and probably get into that mix. If Orange fucking Cassidy can do it, and look at how they've kind of fucking misused him in terms of he's looking like he's going to be a top. Now he's just like the guy who pops up in the, in this fucking, you know, buddy segment. And now, he's wrestling MJF for the ring. No, of course, because, you know, what is Orange Cassidy going to do with the ring? He'll put it in his pocket.
Right.
So I think his argument, he doesn't even make a fucking argument with himself, because basically he's just saying, yeah, I wrote an article.
now pay me.
And by the way, right at the end of the article, he does put his Twitter down there if people want to contact him.
Uh-oh.
But then underneath there's a fucking shill for a subscription to that website. Yep. So obviously he is getting paid, and he does want people to subscribe, because then he gets paid to write this kind of crap.
Bingo.
But you know, it's still something interesting that you did say, Michaels, and this is why, when you, let's go back to your example you said with Dean Ambrose. And this is something that we're going to find out once Seth returns from daddy duty, AKA you're not on SmackDown, is I found WWE has an interesting time of when you have all three members of the Shield or two members on the Shield on one show, and they happen to be the same if they're heel. I find that they have a challenge of trying to showcase that. And I was interested to see what that would have been with Roman's on SmackDown and Seth on SmackDown. But of course, you know, daddy duties.
I'll tell you, just really quick, because I want to get that thought out. Honestly, this time out is kind of, I don't know if it's bad or good for Seth, because when he comes back, Roman is going to be so over as a heel that he has to be face. He's going to be a face against Seth being the most hated heel, because Seth has the fucking goods of being a fucking natural, smarky, you know, a person that you just want to see get his ass kicked. Roman will translate that heelness to finally having the respect, and now you got a feud.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see it, and that's why I said with Dean Ambrose, I want to say with Dean Ambrose in the past when he had the horrible siren music in the background and the freaking brown leather coat with the fur and shit, like he's gonna fly a freaking aviator or some shit. I don't know. And the mask thing and horrible trash can fires and that didn't translate well on tape. I felt like, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't Seth transitioning into heel if he wasn't already heel? And they were on the same show. Was that Seth? I and that's where I'm sketchy on it. I just remember that's when we started seeing a decline with Dean Ambrose.
Remember, so Seth was a face, Ambrose was a heel, and Roman got cancer. Remember,
that was all in that one. And I feel like that, for whatever reason, because when we're talking about TV time, essentially, I always felt like once the Shield broke up, it was difficult to try and showcase them whatever direction they were going to be, whether it was heel capacity or face capacity. And that's why I said, if Dean, like you said, with that contract, it just happened his contract was coming up and there were different opportunities. And so he took it. Yeah. I think that he would have still been very great if he had to stay with WWE and they figured that challenge.
I think that he, you know, here's the thing. The thing is that one of the things that you're comparing that is tough, and he totally avoided this, and that is that one of the reasons Moxley's been able to be that character is because they are allowed to have fucking bloodbaths.
True. Yep.
And so you lose your personality in WWE when you've made your name on having some fucking brutal matches since he was backyard wrestling from the beginning. So, yeah, I mean, it's a footing thing and it's a fucking pecking order and there's a lot of shit. And quite honestly, I always thought that Moxley was the Roddy Piper of his generation. Where he doesn't need a title, he doesn't need the glorification, just needs to go out there, run his fucking mouth because he's really good at it, and have a heel instinct to him, and eventually fans will make him face. AEW basically just did that. Just take the guy as he is, let him run his mouth, he becomes a face, and then you have the extra advantage of being able to have bloodlettings to enhance that image that he's a tough motherfucker.
Well, and the cool thing is you guarantee it, once Ambrose, I'm saying his name now, Moxley, once Moxley comes back, I feel that he's a better chaser. Well, he's a great champion, but I'm saying the chase is going to be him running his mouth, picking freaking fights, whatever he wants to. He could put him in a feud with anybody, and we're going to watch that shit on AEW and be happy to do so. So, yeah. Sorry, WWE, you get to watch and see what you could have done, but whether you didn't do it or not is besides the point. You're going to watch it too.
And out of all those guys, I mean, Moxley to me is really the only one that I think that if you're the WWE and you had a better situation where the contract wasn't up, you could have been able to buff him up a little bit more because you didn't want him to go to AEW. Mm-hmm. And that's what you're seeing right now. What we talked about with Keith Lee. There's a reason Keith Lee's in the ring at the PC, because they want to make him a viable person in the future for them without seeing him leave to AEW or another company.
Yep.
And that's a lot of it. You know, we talked many times about how they, you know, stock up on talent. They don't use this guy and that guy and et cetera, et cetera. I actually implore any wrestling fan who thinks that they know their shit to take every single name on signed to a WWE contract from the bottom to the top, and you figure out how you can run all these people into storylines that showcase these people exactly how you think they should be showcased. It's fucking impossible.
They won't even get past probably a third of the list, if we're being honest, because there's more to it to running a show than you just fucking sitting there with your little Mountain Dew and your potato chips and shit and acting like you know every fucking thing. You gotta give people props where there's due. I mean, yeah, we give WWE shit, but they dealing with a fucking lot of cards.
Oh yeah.
AEW too. They're trying to figure out with a limited deck or a deck that may not transpire. I mean, that honestly, those are motherfuckers I think should get fucking awards. But they get nice paychecks.
Great job, guys. That's what I'm talking about. A good discussion on our three count. That was a really good one. Let's thank our writer again for writing such a great
conflicted article.
Enthralling article.
Let's get to our third count in Sin City. I'll let you kick this one off, man, being that these two hoggers were taking up the
mic all the time. Enjoying that, man. You kidding me?
So this one is from cagesideseats.com, and it's titled Defining Pro Wrestling as an Art Form. I kind of enjoyed the article a little bit, just kind of, you know, hearing the perspective of where he was coming from. But let me just read just a little bit from it here. First off, let me start from the bottom, because he did say that he brought up more questions than provided answers, and that's because there really is no easy answer. So that's you know, and this is of course according to him, but you may find that to be also challenging as we talk about this. He said these are questions that we need to discuss and figure out ourselves, both for our own sake and the sake of wrestling as an art form. So the question first off is asking, is pro wrestling an art form? And he says the obvious answer to most fans is an emphatic yes. Wrestling, we often say to our peers who give us dirty looks for bringing it up, is a piece of performance art. It uses athletic movements in front of an often live crowd meant to bring the illusion of combat while telling a story. We will cite examples of emotion brought up on wrestling match or the pain that a wrestler goes through, to quote Xavier Woods. And this is what he says. Wrestling is one of the last forms of Shakespeare in the round. The crowd is watching men and women tell stories through physicality with an audience at 360-degree setting. Artists use paint to create art on a canvas, and we use our fists and feet to create art on a canvas. It's art. But the author says, but I struggle to really see wrestling defined as art, or at least viewed in the same vein as film and literature. So I'll stop right there and go to one of his next questions he bring up. Where does art begin? Just to read a little bit of that, he said the first thing we must discuss is defining pro wrestling as art is simply, where does the art begin? You know, Dave Meltzer, the guy we mostly look to, tends to rate wrestling on an individual match-by-match basis. This would, in theory, put the art of wrestling as a match-by-match basis. The performers and the action in the rings are the sole things we must look at. This would present wrestling as a form of art similar to a novel or a film. Though they are sometimes part of larger sequences, they are meant to stand on their own as an individual pieces of art. One does not need to read The Hobbit in order to understand The Lord of the Rings. It is a work structured in such a way that what comes before, while relevant, is not directly related to the story of what's happening right now. The last question he poses is the ownership question. If wrestling is an art form, then who is the author? This seems like a simple question, but the title of the author in pro wrestling is an incredibly muddled issue, even with the question of what wrestling is as an art form. He says that before we begin, let's discuss the author means in context. What I'm referring to is the person who claims most responsibility for the work in question. For literature, the answer is, of course, the writer of the book in question. In film, the responsibility is spread thinner. Most agree that it falls on the responsibility of the director. Note how in discussion of Batman versus Superman, the majority of the discussion is concerning the work of Zack Snyder, while Chris Terrio was rarely brought up. I'll stop there, and because you guys also have read all of it, I'm gonna start with you, Sin City. This is I thought it was pretty interesting. Is defining pro wrestling as an art form? Would you believe that it is an art form, or would you have a case to say that it isn't?
Without question, it's an art form. Realistically speaking, I think that the Xavier Woods quote is spot on. Mm-hmm. It's a live action. It's a live action play that is being brought to life by extremely skilled and extremely athletic actors. There's always the age old thing of, oh, well, pro wrestling's fake, blah, blah, blah. No shit. At the end of the day, what they're able to do in the confines of that ring and in the confines of that staging area is to allow people to escape reality. Mm-hmm. Because whatever's going on in outside of those four walls, that doesn't mean a damn thing once you go into the arena or once you immerse yourself into that particular production.
Yeah.
So, you know, just like how Walking Dead is, you know, a show that still has a fan base of millions of people.
Right.
Okay. Well, this is essentially Walking Dead, except it's being acted out in front of your eyes.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you want to look at
you know, stage combat. Another way that you could think about this is, okay, Cirque du Soleil. Okay, there are certain shows that they do have a script. They do have, you know, a set way that things are going to go.
Yeah.
Now, where pro wrestling actually differs from a production like Cirque du Soleil is that every single production is different. And I think that that's something that, you know, we get so wrapped up in, oh, well, who had the better show this week? Who had the better show this week? Be a fan. And, you know, it's something that we mentioned with the last topic, or that I mentioned with the last topic. Mm-hmm. You know, Wednesday nights have become, you know, when it first started out, yeah, obviously, you know, I'm parroting the fact that it's a war and, you know, it's us versus them. Mm-hmm. Well, immediately that is giving me stake in the war because I'm choosing to back whatever product that I'm wanting to back.
Right.
So invariably I have an emotional investment into that roster, and there are wrestlers that I like more than others. So I gravitate more to certain characters. We all do that. And I think that it's something that, you know, realistically is not appreciated nearly as much as it should be. And I think that unfortunately you have a lot of the stigma of, you know, old timey territorial wrestling days, which gets equated to the same things as, oh, well, it's just for rednecks, or, you know, it's just for this particular class of people, or, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing. And I think that is something that this art form has done everything that it can to distinguish itself and actually break those boundaries. And it's something that, you know, newer companies like AEW that are targeting, you know, lapsed fans or people that aren't even pro wrestling, like traditional pro wrestling fans. Mm-hmm. I think that that's where they really shine, because they're going at this from a completely different approach to what we've seen before, while also holding true to the core tenets of what makes pro wrestling great. And it is that escapism. It is what allows us to, you know, close the door on everything that might be going on in our world around us. Once we're in those four walls, the world could be falling apart at the seams and it wouldn't matter. But by God, I'm going to see this guy beat the shit out of this other guy in a completely worked competition, and it's going to give me some sort of closure. And if it doesn't give me some sort of closure, then I'm going to stay tuned so that I finally get that closure.
Right. Let me ask you, Matt Michaels, he although he said, hey, everybody who watched wrestling would say, yeah, sure, it's an art. He says, but again, I struggle to really see wrestling defined as art, or at least viewed as the same vein as film and literature. One of the people I asked said that wrestling was art, but, quote, not the highest of art, end quote. Whatever that means. Disagree with that statement, as I do. Most people do view wrestling in a lowbrow way, and I think that's because, unlike many other forms, the medium of pro wrestling is very difficult to nail down. Would you agree with that statement of what he says?
Talk to Simon really quick, because I have a thought process here.
Okay.
But I want to make sure I get it down clearly. Okay.
Well, let me ask you, Simon. He mentioned a few things. I know you're pretty. I'm sure you've read The Hobbit, but you. But again, you know,
I've read The Hobbit and I've read Lord of the Rings. It's one of my favorite books of all time.
Right. He also mentioned Batman versus Superman. He named the actors on that. I'm trying to figure where that was. But just going back to what
he named the directors.
Directors, that's what it is. Thank you. Yes. So when you look at that, and that was both talking about the ownership question. It was also talking about where does art begin. You know, it's trying to figure out how wrestling is an art. I mean, it's easy to just roll off your tongue and say, yes, yeah, an art, because it is. But how do you define that based on what we've learned as art to be? What would you say, how you connect the things you consider art, video games, the books we just named, the movies, and so on?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned video games, but before I get into that, I'm also going to really quickly just give you the concrete definition of art.
Okay.
The expression or application of human creative skill and imagination, typically in a visual form such as a painting or a sculpture, producing works that can be appreciated primarily for the beauty or emotional power. Okay, that is the concrete definition.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting going back to what you said about video games, because when I look at wrestling and I look at video games and the history of, they're almost parallel if you look at the timeline. As far as the form that we digest today and its evolution that we are seeing, I think that when you look at time, people look at different medias. So if you go back to the Renaissance, art was closely looked at what the times presented as paintings, theatrical art,
mm-hmm.
You know, statues, something visual. And so that's what the standard was for art. Now, that's not to say many, many, many years later, we see different avenues that maybe in its inception, people didn't view it as art because they only looked at that past standard of what's not a painting. It's not an art. You can't go into an amphitheater to see it, but still didn't dispute the fact that it became a mainstay of art. Now, when we look at wrestling, let's be honest. When you talk to most people, unless you talk to Michaels, who can really go back to the territorial days of wrestling, and bless his soul for that, most people really think about the 80s, the 90s, early 2000s to where we are now. Surprisingly enough, video games the same way. People think of technically early 70s, coin op, 80s, you start seeing consoles.
Mm-hmm.
And I could go on for days about just that. I think we're now seeing that, yes, wrestling is art. 100%. It is something that conveys emotion in what it is being presented. You have so many different aspects going into play, from artistic visually, from their intro musics, their marquee videos when they come in, pyro if you got it, their presentation of, you know, athletic visuals, being able to essentially dance. The form of dancing and wrestling is quite amazing if you think about it, because the choreography that goes into play with it. And I'm going to say what Sin City said earlier. Yes, we know it's fucking fake. But still, it's the work that goes into having a sequence choreographed together to do what? Just so we can do a couple of moves that look flashy? No, to convey a story, to present art. Now, we do it on the show, and I'm sure there's tons of people, whether you're smart sitting at home thinking you know everything, or you're an analyst that works for a broadcast or a podcast, you can still look at what's being done in the ring from the time that a person comes through the curtain, per se, and they finish and you hear the 1, 2, 3, and you can see what that means to you. You can analyze it. You can share it. You can be inspired. You can take a time out, as Sin City Steve said earlier, from the world around you and be entertained for that moment in time, that escapism, that art back in the Renaissance provided you. I'm going to have some freaking wine and look at a piece of art and sit there and just look at it and escape from the fact of the tax collectors or the fact that the aqueducts aren't working too well in my sector of the Roman Empire. Do you see what I'm saying? Even let's go back further prehistorically. Cave paintings, art, told a story, gave you a timeline of what life was. There goes an old saying that is, what is art? Does art imitate life, or does life imitate art? And I probably paraphrase that, but it goes without saying that wrestling is art, and it's our art, and it's something that we should cherish. It's something that we should always look to want to build, whether it's to talk about it like mm-hmm. we do.
Yeah.
We're adding to the art. And yes, it's art. It's beautiful. I love it.
I'm going to let Matt Michaels go without asking him a question, but I just wanted to read a couple of comments that was just on the site itself. Just a few comments. Pro wrestling is an art. I don't know why there's even a debate or essay. It is art like Broadway is. And the person responds, because if something is seen as being art, its position as art deserves to be discussed, challenged, and interrogated. Pro wrestling may be an art, but in the same way that video games and Marvel movies may be art, but pretending like all those things are definitely inherently art benefits nobody but lazy thinkers. And then, of course, someone responded, art is not for thinkers, it's for people who feel. Art is the language of the conscience. It's not about picking it apart and dissecting it. It's simply to be experienced. Okay, with that, Matt Michaels, what's your take on this particular article?
Okay, and then the reason I kind of wanted to take a second is because it's a complex thing here.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm going to start with the idea of film. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So you have what is considered films that are art house films, literally
mm-hmm.
art house films. Now, DJ, remember a little film called Armageddon?
Yes.
Right. Michael Bay does not make art. Michael Bay makes films that make money.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Bay can make something that is appealing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Shit blowing up is very appealing to people going into movie theaters, right? You want that escapism, right? Whereas, bless you.
Thank you.
Whereas, now you got the Rona, apparently.
Oh, please don't
Way
say
to go,
that.
Steve.
You got the ham right?
From the last show, right?
Hey, if we're passing it digitally, I'm not going to be here next week. I'll be gone for 2 weeks.
So the thing is, art house films, right, are typically films that are lower budget and are movies that they explore ideas and concepts and human emotions and things that are typically either debated or, you know, what makes us as societies, as people, you know, work, tick.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a Marvel movie, the art for that is more so how much money can it make the studio?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'll tell you right now, right? If a Marvel movie, let's say Iron Man, first one that kind of kicks off this whole universe, if Iron Man doesn't make money, you don't see the Marvel universe. Okay? So therefore, you can argue that films like that are an art form because you have good actors. You have great special effects. You have good cinematographers. You have great sound. You have all these people who might be artists in their own way of execution.
Mm-hmm.
But the main goal is for the Disney company to make money. Vince McMahon is not a fucking artist. Vince McMahon is a goddamn fucking moneymaker.
Mm.
That's it. Tony Khan is not an artist. He is a fucking guy who comes from money and from that family, right? Mm-hmm. So therefore, what you're looking at is money versus craft. Now, when you talk about craft, this is where it becomes very interesting on this aspect. Don't look at AEW or WWE or maybe even, you know, Impact, Ring of Honor. They're all owned by companies.
Mm-hmm.
They're all owned by companies. But independent wrestling, owned by usually one or two people who own a company.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have is a situation where wrestling can be considered an art form because of the people who actually do it, i.e. the actors in an art house film. You're now an independent wrestler. You are showing. The reason you get to the WWE is because you show that you can tell a story. Okay?
Yeah.
That's where a good wrestler like Daniel Bryan, it takes some years, but eventually he gets there. Samoa Joe, it takes some years, but eventually gets there. But a guy like, Roman Reigns, he gets there because of the fact that when you look at him, you see money in the business, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Rock is the best example of, if you look at all the films he's done, he's become a better actor. And I think he's, you know, if given the chance to play an art house film, he would be wonderful at telling the art. And the same thing with him as a wrestler. If you put him on, if he wasn't The Rock, but he was just telling a story, you would probably get a pretty interesting match. But because of his persona and because of the fact that the guy prints fucking money just by raising a goddamn eyebrow, right? Also, what does he sell? Merchandise. Art doesn't sell merchandise. Mm. Art is there to make a specific point. With that being said, now you're looking at Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan is the ideal example of why commercialism works in the United States. Because Hulk Hogan here did not have to be a fucking artist. He had to be a good character. But in Japan, Hulk Hogan had to be a good wrestler. He had to be an artist because the Japanese audience, they look at wrestling from a totally different perspective that we do.
Mm-hmm.
We look at wrestling as like we look at a Michael Bay film. More fireworks, more blood, more fucking, you know, jumps off of fucking towers and stuff.
Right.
Whereas Japanese audiences, what do they do?
Mm-hmm.
That's the highest fucking honor you can get from them.
Right,
getting fucking applause.
Sure.
Right? Mm-hmm. And that goes to show, you can go, well, Mick Foley was an artist. Well, Mick Foley was a good storyteller, but in terms of being an artist, getting thrown off of a cage and having that be your most remembered moment, mm-hmm. that wasn't art. That was him basically saying, hey, what can we do to fucking up the next person, right? What's good? You know, that match was so good that we need to do it even more so, to the point where you take that bump and then what do? You're so fucking out of it that you still want to go back up on that cage and you have no sense that that fucking cage is about to give and your ass goes straight through it. That man is lucky he didn't die that night.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's not art. That's brutality. That's that is what the Romans did when they put people into the fucking in front of the lions, man.
No, I hear you. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the closest thing that I think is you can say individual performers are artists, just as you know, you can say Robert De Niro is a great artist because he can be in a film that he conveys everything just by talking very, very, you know, with his eyes, with his words, you get engaged, very artsy.
Yeah.
All right. Very intimate. But then he could be in a fucking, you know, Meet the Falkers and just make a fucking shitload of money. And
right.
It's just like, okay, is he not any less of an artist? No, he's a businessman too. But at the same rate, what I loved here is this fact. Pat Patterson, who just passed away, one of the things about Pat Patterson that made him an artist is Pat had a concept for the Royal Rumble. Now, it's great if you have a concept, but you need a couple things. You need a pallet, which was the WWE ring or a stage, right? Now, the next thing you need is you need the right people to paint that picture, right? No one had ever thought of taking wrestlers, starting off to taking that battle royal concept and basically deconstructing it. Really popular right now are restaurants who take like a peanut butter jelly sandwich and fucking deconstruct it, and you can fucking charge $35 for that sandwich.
Yeah,
that you can make for $1.50.
Right.
Yep.
That's the idea. He took something. He said, I can see this. Now, if I put this part here and I do this, now you're starting to see it. When you go to a play, what you see on stage is the perspective of the director or the playwright, and these come together. So these are all people who come together to make these facets happen.
Yeah.
So yeah, there is an artistic aspect of pro wrestling, no doubt. But there are different levels of that artistic aspect, and the overall aspect is it's a business.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in this business to be an artist, and this is something that everyone says about acting, right? What is that thing? You're a starving artist. But they never say you're a starving movie maker, because if you're making the film, if you're making, you know, if you are on the WWE roster, you've gone from an artist to a professional now.
Mm-hmm.
And your goal is now not how can I tell my story and make this great. Your goal is, okay, this is called a gobbledygooker. Just put on the fucking thing, go out there and dance and do a do-si-do.
Right.
Because guess what? You have a family, and that family needs to eat, and your kids need to go to college. You need to put clothes on people. And that's the difference between what an artist is and what a professional is. An artist will die for their art. A professional will die for their paycheck.
Mm.
Can I ask you a question with that? Because that was brilliant.
Good job, man. So that's awesome.
What does that make us?
Oh boy!
You know,
easy now.
Really,
easy.
In all honesty,
I think we're starving artists.
In a sense, yes. Because if we were getting, you know, if we were getting Conrad Thompson money, right? We are professionals.
Yeah.
And you damn straight make sure that a show is out every fucking week, and that everything is, and you've got people doing your social media for you. You got people doing your legal for you. You got people doing your tax. You have all these components. For us, yes, we're making a certain kind of art. It's an entertainment art, and it's more so it's more so the equivalent to Commedia dell'arte, where we are basically doing theater of the absurd, because if you think about it, we are five guys who come together who really have no business talking about the mechanics of wrestling, because we are not people who were professionals, right?
Mm.
What we are is we are presenting a product purely for the entertainment, the enjoyment, and maybe a little in-depth here and a little in-depth there. But we are not, you know, like our last pal who wrote that fucking, you know, letter-by-letter essay to make money.
Nope.
We are spewing our shit to hopefully entertain people. And at that point, yes, you can consider us starving artists, but we have a niche. And I think that most podcasts are that, you know. The people who make money in podcasting are typically people who either co-host the show with a known commodity or are the known commodity themselves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you tune into particular podcasts that you like the topics, you like the people doing it, whatever you feed into it, that's why you listen. And that's why Also, don't forget, in this day and age, it's so easy for people to take the equipment, if they have it, and to put out some kind of product.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's just the society we're in now, is you can get instant gratification from anything now. So,
yeah,
I mean, honestly, let's face it. You can take certain pornos.
That's art.
And look at it. And there are some directors out there who the whole Boogie Nights, the whole point of Burt Reynolds' character, and also then from him stemming down to his actors and to his production team, was these were people who were grasping to the idea that what they did mattered, and they were artists. They were putting out films. He said, you know, I make films. And what happened to the porn industry? The 80s came, VHS came in, and it killed any artistic thing that it had, because now it became simply about money.
Yeah, and now Pornhub won't even take my Visa and MasterCard. So I mean, they won't even take my money now.
The reason for the reason for that is because every time you set up a subscription, there's somebody, I don't know who it is, that keeps taking that bad boy off. They got tired of that shit.
DJ, there's something that you're not quite grasping here. Okay. You have a maximum daily withdrawal amount. Exactly.
And not only on your credit card.
Hello.
Through your junk.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, man. Hey,
guys.
We're just happy that you really started incorporating the proper lubricants and lotions into your routine, man. Because for a second, man, you were starting to be like 3 hours of raw.
Oh, man. To all of our listeners, the bottom.
Literally 3 hours of raw.
3 hours literally. Raw.
Yeah. To all our listeners,
pull that one off.
Please help us get to that Conrad Thompson money, please. That was the whole purpose of our last three count topic, but just get us to that Conrad Thompson money. No,
let's start with the basics of doing that, and that is Charlotte. Just break it off with Andrade.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Any one of us five. His family marrying into the Flair family.
Boom. Right.
If that were to happen, that would be something for anybody that's listening. If you are listening to that just for sheer shits and giggles and LOLs, please write into Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting and let us know what you think of that. Who out of the bad boys would be a suitor to marry into the Flair family via Charlotte? I want to be entertained and find out who it is.
Oh, boy.
I just, whoever, whichever five, the one of us,
yeah,
out of the five of us who can drink the most has got it.
Yeah, boom.
You got to have a liver to be in the Flair family, man.
I don't know about that. I mean, out of the four of us is here, which one can drink more?
Well, that'll be you, Street. Now, look here.
Oh, come on, man.
We, that is our three count. We're going to give our final thoughts for for the week. So let's let you kick it off, Street. What you want to tell the people out there?
I want to tell everybody, thank you so much for tuning into the stream. Thank you for supporting us. To all of our day one people, we thank you even more. Yes. Because you have been there, tried and true, through quarantines, out quarantines, showing up when we had live events. And we don't forget that, and we remember that. And for everybody that's new, that's tuning in, there's always something new on the horizon. We're not just five guys who appear on a podcast and we're looking to just sell you peanut butter and jelly sandwiches every Sunday. We are definitely stepping up our game, and eventually we're going to add new things that you'll see eventually one day that you can jump into. Thank you.
All right, Sin City Steve.
Thank you guys for hanging out with us tonight in the chat. Thank you guys for liking, sharing, subscribing, all that kind of fun stuff. We make jokes, but to be honest, you guys are the real reason why we're doing this. So thank you so much. And a special thank you to all of our armed forces members serving both foreign and domestically. And a special shout out to our boy, the Storm and Mormon. Thank you for all that you guys do. We appreciate you. And we'll see you soon.
No doubt. Matt Michaels.
So, you know, this this past couple days ago, five or so days ago, Katie Forbes, who, man, if you want to talk about one of the sweetest, sweetest people, man, she's an amazing person. Her and Rob Van Dam have been, you know, just wonderful here, not only to us, but, you know, to everyone that they come across in Vegas. They're just wonderful people. And Katie and her younger brother, I believe it's her younger brother. I'm not positive if he's older or younger, but he passed away unexpectedly a couple days ago. It's tough because not only is this her brother, but you know, he had his wife Candace. He had three kids, and 7 years old, 5 years old, and 13 months, man. There is a GoFundMe set up. You can look it up. It's under the Ben Bright Memorial page on GoFundMe. This is legitimately set up by Katie and another friend, Regina. You know, everything is on there in terms of showing that it's legitimate. This is something, again, that is just incomprehensible, especially with everything that's going on with COVID. This doesn't seem to be related to COVID. So we hear about all these, you know, numbers and these stories and stuff, and then we forget that every day people are still dying from various other things. Mm-hmm. And it's harder now to even conceive of things because of the fact that with that, you know, being in a pandemic, there's a lot of unemployment. There's a lot of situations that, you know, we don't know. And it's just out of the goodness of people's hearts. So far, they've raised $27,000 plus out of a $50,000 goal. And everything that's contributed is, you know, for this expenses of the memorial costs and to also help the three kids, you know, in the future as well as in the present. And it just would mean the world to us if you're, you know, if you're hearing this and maybe you've never come across Katie personally, maybe you're a fan, maybe you've never heard of Katie before. I just would encourage you to please look that up and, you know, donate what you can, you know, because it is hard times and everyone is, you know, scrounging around. But at the same time, man, even, you know, $5 helps, man, because he was a young man, you know, he was, I think 36 or 37, man. And, you know, and some of you guys here on the show, you know, you're right in that ballpark, you know, and, none of us are expecting, you know, any one of us to pass away anytime soon. So it is a fucking shock to the system when you hear about something like this. And, Katie knows that our best wishes are with her and the family, and our thoughts and prayers and everything is with them in this tough time. And again, please just, you know, if you have a chance, and even if you can't donate, please go to one of Katie's either Twitter or to her Instagram and just share condolences, because man, it means a lot to know that the people that you do this for, that you entertain, it means a lot when you show that you've got, you know, the compassion and the heart, to send condolences, and to know that, you know, we care. And that's the biggest thing as fans. These people entertain us, and, you know, sometimes you don't get a chance to show you care. And in this, you do. And it's also a good way to remember that no matter who it is who performs and entertains, they're just as human as any of us are. And you need that that comfort every once in a while when things like this in your life come unexpectedly. So between that news and Tiny's passing, Tiny Lister was just out here. I believe he did an autograph signing at
Versus, right?
Yeah, he was at Versus. He stopped by Versus, yeah. And he did an autograph signing, I believe, for Scott Hosey at his collectibles shop. So, it's sometimes it just you never know, and sometimes some weeks are kind of more sad than others. So, let's hope next week is a little more positive week, and that. Let's just get into 2021 and hopefully no one has to go through, you know, this type of heartache and loss that a lot of people are going through this year.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Matt Michaels. We thank all of you guys for listening, and we definitely appreciate you. Believe it or not, every time you listen or download, it moves us one step forward to maybe reach other people who can use a little bit of comedy or laughter, or just, listening to different thoughts and ideas of things we do. So we definitely appreciate it. With that, we will see you next week. And don't forget, tomorrow also will be the DeFalco Files. Please download that. For all of our podcast listeners, all right? Till then, we're out. Peace.
Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting.